when Yoshimitsu and I were travelling up in the foothills of the Himalayas, we had been going to see Dharma Rinpoche, but we decided not to go and see him because Dharma Rinpoche was too ill. So instead we'd go across to Kathmandu and we'd see Mogachitta, have a look at the Tibetan monasteries there, and maybe even see if we could see Dolgo Kensi Rinpoche. As luck would have it, Dolgo Kensi Rinpoche was in his monastery in Baudnath, just outside Kathmandu. And we went up, and there was a very large reception room in which there were many, many monks. Well, not many. There were maybe about 20 or 30 people sitting around this lounge, many of them monks, and quite a number of Western disciples. And I'm afraid we weren't at all impressed by the Western disciples. Some of them seemed to be in really very odd states indeed. And I felt quite embarrassed sitting there in the lounge, sort of to be associated with these, you know, quite odd, strange characters. And as we were sitting there, well, we were told first of all that you know, we probably wouldn't be able to see him, but you know, if we waited, we might have a space, because what he was doing was he was passing on teachings to some lamas, some tulkus who'd come to visit. You know, we could hear sort of various things going on behind the glass partition. And that after these lamas had gone, another set of tulkus would appear, and he'd give those ones initiations and pass on teachings. But in the space in between, maybe you might get a chance to see him. And one sort of Western nun, she sort of looked after us and said, well, you know, just wait. She'd had some contact with the FWO. In fact, she'd passed on all her furniture to the FWO when she'd sold up in London to go out to Kathmandu. She'd passed on all her furniture to Buddhadasa's shop. You know, we did the second-hand business. So we had some bit of contact with her. The glass doors open, and out come all these lamas, maybe about 10 or 12 lamas, you know, coming out. And everybody else who was waiting in this reception, you know, just sort of swept in, and we were sort of, you know, in you go, now's your chance. So we just sort of were standing at the back, and we had quite a chance just to watch Dolgo Kensi Rinpoche sitting, you know, by a very large sort of bay window. He was sitting at one end of the bay window on an upraised bed, sort of couch thing. And a very, very big man, undressed right down to his waist. And it seems this is very common for Dolgo Kensi Rinpoche. I don't know what it was like in Manti's day, but certainly many of the photographs you see, and I've hunted through lots of the magazines that, you know, I've got photographs of him, and many of them you see him just sort of undressed down to the waist. And there's one photograph where he's even selecting the site of a stupa, and he's supported in the countryside by some people on this side and some people on this side. He's sort of standing there, and all he's got on is like a petticoat. That's all. He's got, you know, he just seemed to, well, according to one woman I spoke to, just at the first sort of opportunity, he would just take his robes off and just sort of, you know, be on his throne and just cover himself all with a blanket. And that's all. They just have a little petticoat underneath. Well, a big petticoat, actually. And, you know, there he was, just sitting this big blanket over him. And, you know, just a smattering of grey hair over the top of his head. And, you know, sort of very full-chested man. And quite a very deep voice. You could hear him. You couldn't hear what he was saying, but you could hear him, in, you know, across the other side of the room. He was quite a barrel-chested man, with this big, deep voice. And, you know, several people went up to meet him. And there was one man I noticed particularly went up to meet him. And I just watched the two of them. Obviously, they knew each other. And knowing each other, you know, you could tell from the recognition on Dolgo Kensi Rinpoche's face and the way he laughed, and the both of them laughed together, that there was no sort of awkwardness between the two of them. And there was no sort of unnatural standing on ceremony by the visitor, by the disciple to Rinpoche. You know, he was just quite happy to just listen to the man, and they had a joke here and there. And then the man sort of, you know, bowed down, received the traditional scarf as a blessing, and off he went. And the next people went forward. And in due course, well, the woman who was looking after us, the Western woman, just sort of nudged and said, now's your chance, go forward now. And as we went forward, each of us with our scarves at the ready, at that very moment, as we were just bowing down, Kensi Rinpoche's physician passed him a big metal spoon full of medicine, which he had to pop into his mouth. And it was a foul-tasting medicine, obviously, because as we were bowing down, as each time we were coming up, we could see he was going... yeah. And having taken one spoon of it, I think he had to take a second spoon. And of course, by this time, we'd finished our prostrations, we'd passed across our scarves, which we laid in front of him, and started to tell the interpreter who we were, where we'd come from, who our teacher was, and why we'd come to visit Dogu Kensi Rinpoche. All the time, he sort of... he was trying to sort of, you know, look down at its obviously very bitter medicine, and you know, as I went on explaining the story, he sort of, you know, took some sip of some water or something to wash down the medicine, and he said, "Oh, it's, you know, very good to hear your disciples of Sangharakshita. Where's Sangharakshita now? Is he in America? No, he's in England. Oh, that's very good, Sangharakshita. Yes." And then I asked the question which I'd come to ask, and that was, would Dogu Kensi Rinpoche tell the story of his life before I left Kathmandu? So he said, "Well, how long are you in Kathmandu for?" So I said, "Well, I'm in Kathmandu for just a few days." So he said, "Well, in that case, it wouldn't be possible." He didn't say no. He didn't say no, he wouldn't do it. But he said, you know, "Well, in this case, it wouldn't be possible just, you know, within the next few days." And, you know, what I should have said, I think now I should have said, "Well, look, I'd be willing to come back if you tell me when to come back. I'll be willing to be there to receive that story if you tell it." But in fact, all I said was, "Well, you know, Rinpoche, please, you know, tell your life story before, you know, before it's too late, because you never know what's going to happen." And you know, he thanked us for the visit and gave us each a scarf, myself, Yashimitra, and the young Nepalese friend that we'd come with, and made our bows, and then we left the room. And that was our very pleasant and, in some ways, you know, quite encouraging visit to Dogu Kensi Rinpoche. And although he was having medicine at the time when we met him, he was obviously able to, you know, to listen to what was going on and to respond in an appropriate way. And to me, respond sensitively. So, you know, I certainly appreciated that, and I was quite glad to have just seen him there and see, well, you know, here he was, 79 years old, and still working as he had been working, you know, for the whole of his life, just, you know, learning and teaching. So that's my story of Dogu Kensi Rinpoche. And I think you can fill in some more personal impressions, Bhante, of when you met him in Kalimpong.